Well, it's been a while since we've spoken.
Yeah, it's been a couple, it's almost been a couple years, I think.
Yeah. Are you still, I mean, what's COVID like for you right now?
So, I live in Austin, so we've got, the city is really one culture in terms of mask wearing, and then there's the surrounding neighborhoods, and no, it's getting better. Thankfully the rates are going down. Students are going back to school. It's been kind of in phases, but, it has been a crazy year to say the least. They say hindsight is 2020, right? Let's hope so.
Yeah, the sooner we get 2020 in our hindsight, the better.
Exactly. Yeah, how are you doing? How's I've been watching off and on, but a lot more lately. You've got your estuary going and some new initiatives online. And
yeah, mostly not a lot going yet, but some more of that is coming.
Probably don't hear me real well here. That's probably better. Basically a lot of ideas and some new initiatives, and of course COVID is kind of, you know, it's enormous disruption and pain in the neck, but it's also an opportunity. So playing around with some things in terms of church life, and then maybe in the next couple of weeks some more things to announce that are more estuary like. So bit by bit stuff will come. You know, I'm trying to do this and not do it as a job, but sort of inspire people to sort of do it. I mean, that in some ways, my YouTube channel isn't my job, and listening to my YouTube videos isn't anybody else's job. And so it's something we're sort of doing on the periphery. So we'll see what can be done in that respect. So now if I recall correctly, you're a teacher, correct?
That's right. That's right.
And have you been teaching on Zoom, or have you had class in person, or?
We've been doing a little bit of both. So starting in April last year, it was all online. We just, you know, got through the end of the spring, and then we did the summer. You know, we were looking to the fall, and it looked like, are we going to be in person? Are we going to be online again? Huge uncertainty. But we've been coming in social distance, appropriate ways, coming together in small groups. And now that schools are kind of getting back on, we're trying to ease back into full time being in person, you know, wearing masks. And but it's you know, this has been hugely disruptive for schools and for churches. And so, yeah, it just feels like the response. I've really appreciated what you've done in terms of just seeing it as an opportunity to be creative and learn how to use Zoom, reach out to people. You know, you already knew how to do that, but I tell you, learning how to teach on Zoom has not been easy, but you know, you make an adjustment here and there, and eventually it starts to become second nature.
Yeah. Now you've sent me some emails, and so you've got some stuff you want to talk to me about. So let's jump in and where do you want to go with this?
Well, you had a couple of videos recently that you've kicked out a couple of phrases, and you've hit on some topics that I'm super interested in. So, I think the biggest thing is, recently, you know, as you've engaged kind of with this, secularity question and modernity, I guess I'd like to unpack a little bit more what have you been learning about, and particularly like John Vervaeke's conversations. I've really appreciated some of those, and just recently re-listened to his last lecture on the meaning crisis. How's your thought on secularity changing in these recent months? It seems like you did a review of kind of the conversation partners you've been having. It was really helpful because you kind of gave a table of contents of maybe the last 2 years of your videos in some sense.
Yeah. That's, I guess that's true. I guess that's, I recorded that and I thought, is this one worth it? I often have that. I record a video and I think, should I even post this? Maybe I'll just delete it. But then it's like, I just throw it out there, see what happens. So I've been wrestling with, so obviously if you're a Christian who believes in the church, part of the idea of church is, well, the Greek word, it's an assembly. So it's a gathering. Once you have a gathering, you both have those who have gathered and those who haven't gathered. And obviously, so I was just preaching through the plagues a little while ago, and God makes a distinction between Israel and Egypt. And then I preached on Genesis or Exodus 19 and 20 last week. And, you know, the Lord says to Israel, I have delivered you out of Egypt on eagle's wings. And if you fully obey me, I will, you know, take you to myself and make you my treasured possession. And this is the fulfillment of this. We're going to go out into the desert and worship our God. And so in Christianity, there is always this sense of those who are in and those who are out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that maps on in some ways. You have the Jew and the Gentile, the Greek and the Roman and the barbarian. You have civilized and uncivilized. You have good people and bad people. And there's always this dynamic. Well, secularity, I think, in many ways, in terms of the public imaginary, has been this is free, open air nature. And churches are, you know, churches are like a building, and Islam is a building, or the Republican Party is a building. Cultures are buildings, and the church is sort of, or secularity is sort of being outside. Now, this has been, in Reformed and conservative Reformed circles, this has been denied and argued against for a very long time, that secularity is just another worldview. And so, you know, you've got some Dutch Reformed theologians and philosophers that have been playing with these ideas, and the deconstruction of secularity has been around in conservative Reformed and Dutch Reformed circles for quite a while. And you can hear, you know, you can see that peeking out when Tim Keller makes comments about, you know, when he does in his sermons kind of deconstruct secularity. And so I've been doing a lot of thinking about secularity. A number of months ago, John Vervaeke and Christopher Mastropietro approached me about participating in another book that they wanted to write. And I've always sort of toyed with doing some writing in a longer, more disciplined way. And I thought, okay, I'll say yes. And so then not too long after I said yes, I thought I should not have said yes. Because, you know, COVID came in and life came in and things were crazy. And then I procrastinated. And then finally, no, I got to write this darn thing. And so I, you know, took a couple of weeks where I really worked hard on it while, you know, still having to do everything else. It didn't make as many videos. And I wrote a thing, and I wasn't sure if what I wrote. See, the problem with me writing things, it's exactly the same problem I have with my videos, but the video format affords it much better, because after I write something, I read it, and it's like, I don't really like that. So then I rewrite it.
Yeah.
And I just keep rewriting the darn thing. I know a lot of people, they write and then they edit and then they're done. I just keep rewriting it. So all of my videos are basically, they're the next draft.
Yeah.
And so.
And I appreciate the fact that you kick it out there without a lot of editing and that you're just drafting. I think what you have shown in particular, you know, in the ongoing conversation with John Vervaeke is, you know, it feels like a real dialogue. It feels like a real mutual conversation that, you know, it's just kind of hard to find that. It's hard to find it on substantive topics where we linger long enough on the same thing. And yeah, it's just, I just appreciate that. So on secularity, I sent you the article from the Essential Niebuhr book on secularity, because I thought what was so fascinating about that is the paragraph where he's saying, okay, secularity, how do we define this term? What if we read it through the parable of the prodigal son? What if, and so when I, hearing some of your conversations, especially some of your recent videos, Tom Holland comes to mind, Dominion, but the idea that we have, and Niebuhr says this, like we in the church are defining secularity very much too much in the Enlightenment modern understanding and self-concept here. And I can't remember the first time I heard the notion that secularity itself is the offspring of Christianity. I mean, it shows up in the Niebuhr. It's like you wouldn't even have Western secularity were it not for its Christian, Jewish Christian patrimony.
Yes.
It's in the DNA.
Yes. And so this piece that I wrote that will come out. So then eventually I wrote this thing and I sent it to Christopher and John, and then I avoided, and then Christopher sent back some edits. It's like, I don't have time for edits. And then John said, you know, what's going on? Where are the edits? I thought I'm swamped right now. I've got all kinds of craziness going on. He said, well, why don't Christopher and I edit this first? And so then they edit it and then it sent it back to me. And then it's like, okay, I need a deadline. So they gave me a deadline and I read through it and I made some changes, but I really liked what they did. And so I'm really pleased with the chapter, but sort of the fruit of that coming out of the Tom Holland stuff was I began to recognize, and I basically said that in some ways, secularity is the second sister of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, you know, saw that listening to Tom Holland and his talk about India, in terms of, because India, you have this other culture that wasn't completely disconnected from the West, right, but is different enough from the West. And said, of course, the British come in and they slowly begin to conquer India and unite India. And of course, this is the period of, well, we're going to make you Christians, because Christianity is not this segmented thing. It's the truth and it's the way the world works. So we, being generous, enlightened, brilliant, smart people who know the way the world works, we're going to give you what we have. And it's the same motivations of the Romans trying to, you know, enlighten the Jews and get them rid of their backwards religious ways. It's exactly the same motivation with the United Nations wanting to get the African countries to affirm same-sex relationships. You know, it's all colonialism. It doesn't end. And people say, oh, colonialism is bad. We need to teach these Africans to start embracing same-sex marriage. It's like, do you not see any ironies in this?
Yeah, yeah.
So then the question is, well, India says no to the church, but eventually, you know, after Gandhi, of all people, Gandhi, who of course, you know, spent a stint in South Africa and became a lawyer and, you know, deeply influenced by Tolstoy,
mm-hmm.
you know, after Gandhi, India becomes a secular state. And of course, via communism, China becomes an atheistic state. Japan becomes, secularism conquered the world in a way that the 17th, 18th, 19th century colonials dreamed Christianity would.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And do you think that maybe evangelical, maybe fundamentalist or evangelical, or even mainline Protestant the way that the conversation has been about secularity is to see it as like a subtraction definition. It's like the absence of religion when it's really a DNA definition that we need. I'm thinking of Peter Berger in some ways here too. It seems like I don't know, I haven't read the book, but is it The Sacred Canopy?
I haven't read it either, but yeah, that's the title.
I think if I remember his contribution to the secularity conversation, it's that, you know, he was reared in the subtraction narrative, right? That secularity is the shoveling off of Christian. And then of course, discovering that how much secularity owes to Christian. An example of that, you know, communism, I can't remember if it was Chesterton or somebody, no, it wouldn't have been. It's basically a Christian, Jewish Christian heresy. It's eschatology minus God, you know, like here's a bright future of the kingdom of God on earth minus God. And it's like, yeah, that comes from your Jewish roots, Marx. That's, you didn't find that reading Nietzsche, or he wouldn't have read Nietzsche, but he didn't find that reading Darwin. That's not the end of the line there.
Right, right. Well, and you, quite frankly, probably can't have Darwin without Christianity either. And
yeah. Yes, correct.
And that's what we're stuck with all over the place. And what I think we see happening. So I just I'm interested in David Sloan Wilson right now and some of the work that he's done, because, you know, basically, you know, some of these evolutionary biologists, Brett Weinstein as well, have been out there making the point that, you know, Dawkins didn't go far enough, in that you don't simply have human beings without the software.
Right.
And the software and the hardware have been co-evolving for a very long time. And so, yeah, you can't understand Marx or Darwin or Dawkins without Christianity. It's baked into, now it's baked into both the software and the hardware. And so secularity is part of that package. So what then do we really mean by religion? And so then the Tom Holland stuff is fascinating, mm-hmm. because the observation he makes, which he's not alone in making it, many have made it beforehand. And once you see it, then you go back and say, read the Bible, and yeah, just pull out a concordance and look at how many times religion is mentioned in humanity's quintessentially religious book. And, you know, basically a couple of quotes from the book of James. So what's going on with us? And now we seem to be arriving at the end of modernity, where all kinds of people are coming to the point, a la Jordan Peterson. He really sort of, you know, caused a minor explosion of this, that people are saying, I need software. And the software I can't escape is Christian software. So then back to me as a pastor, with all my life I've noted, okay, we have our folks here in the church, and then we have our folks outside the church. And well, there's a whole lot of commonality between them. You know, even in deeply conservative, antithetical, and when I say the antithesis, I mean, in Reformed and Dutch Reformed doctrine, the antithesis is light and dark. And so you had someone like Herman Hoeksema deny common grace. Oh, that's pretty antithetical. And you had Abraham Kuyper, you know, working with those issues. But then the question, okay, so all of these deeply conservative fundamentalists are, so in church, they're professing that evolution is wrong, and, you know, we're going to be against anybody who teaches evolution. But doggone it, when when they get sick, they go to a doctor that's been completely reared in all of those models, and they trust his medicine, and they trust the economics. They trust the entire system that is built on all of these things that they deny, and they say, this is not the truth. Let me fill up my gas with petroleum that was found with geological models based on things that I say are utter lies of the devil. And it's like, okay. Right.
And how much of that is so owing to, you know, just American Protestant history, you know, and the fundamentalist and the liberal divide that, you know, made it seem like that was the only way to be faithful in the early 20th century and regarding these things. You know, I remember when I started studying theology about 20 years ago, it was the science and faith conversation that really, really engaged me. I had studied biology for a couple years in college and then switched to Spanish. but I'd gotten far enough into it to really dive in to the basics of evolution. And I thought, bird's claws, scales on bird's feet, Archaeopteryx fossil in China with claws on the wings and feathers. I think they're dinosaurs. You know, I think that's what, you know, and then just feeling like in order to be faithful, you know, I don't know. I think the first wedge for me was old Earth and, you know, kind of sort of in the creator in the cosmos. Who wrote that book? It's old Earth perspective. But the idea of evolution, and then realizing, wait a second, the entire Western scientific enterprise itself owes philosophically and historically so much to Christianity that it, again, once you shed the secularism worldview and the perspective on the history and philosophy of science, and that's not just me saying that, like the discipline of the history of science in the early 20th century took a sharp turn away from secularism to starting to recognize the actual contribution, like the incarnation had. Like if God, if the good beyond the sun is willing to descend into human flesh, then matter must be good enough to study. And that gave an enormous impetus to the early, and all the early scientists, modern scientists, Kepler and Galileo, they were all Christian. They all felt like this was being faithful to their vocation. And Darwin himself gave to missions. He gave to Anglican missions. His wife was a devout believer. He studied theology. I think it was, you know, he was working on the clockmaker thesis when he, you know, he's developing his, you know, I think I even read somewhere that the Wedgwoods, his in-laws, were strident abolitionists, and that in some ways he was motivated in his unity of the human race to sort of hypothesize that, that it's in a man that this is, we have common ground here. We're of one stock. So yeah, I guess what I'm rambling a little bit on that, but to me, I agree. I think when Jordan Peterson came out with obviously such a rich understanding of not just evolution, but how our psychic mechanism, reflects our evolutionary kind of just the way we evolve meaning mechanisms. I haven't read Maps of Meaning, but I need to. I see the parallel between John Verbeke and him in terms of just even perception and how that's rooted so deeply in biology. And, you know, Dawkins is sitting here harping away on the old, or Sam Harris, you know, let's get beyond faith. It's like, do you not recognize you would not even have the very science and the rationalism that you cherish so much if it hadn't been that you studied at Oxford, that you teach at American universities that are how many decades away from being secular, I mean, essentially Protestant mainline denominational schools. Yeah. And it's like, I'm sorry, but just the institutional space itself for science, I'm not saying that obviously there's a distinction in terms of method and philosophy of science, but just the empiricism itself actually drew a lot from Christian influence. And notwithstanding, there's been a ton of roadblocks and inefficiencies thrown in the path as well. Yeah, that qualifier has to be put out there.
Well, and part of, you know, I don't want to just beat up on the fundamentalists, but the word evolution is so triggering because of this, you know, because of this institutional warfare that happened at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. And right. Because if I say evolution, quite rightly, the meaning is forked. One meaning is obviously that, that God achieves, from a Christian perspective, that God achieves ends via processes. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that should be the most obvious thing in terms of that itself is in some ways based upon the entire genre and framework of the Bible. The Bible is the story of God achieving what you have at the new heavens and the new earth from the, in the beginning, you know, God created heaven and earth. I mean, the entire process is, the entire genre is a process. That is a narrative. It's a story. It's a process. And so sometimes when we use that word evolution, we talk about process, but then there's this other, there's this other understanding that no, this is a blind process divorced of conscious intent. Mm-hmm. Oh, is that what I meant by that word? That might be what you meant by that word, but okay. So now we're in the horns of many, many more things. And so as a pastor, you begin to recognize that on one hand, I do need to live with ins and outs. I do need to live with labels on groups. Yeah. And so the label of Christian is not a meaningless, useless label. At the same time, you know, I think one of the most important things Jordan Peterson did on his wave was be on Bill Maher, where, you know, this group of people are in a certain tone of voice, yucking it up at all of those imbeciles that are, you know, that voted for Donald Trump. And Jordan mm-hmm. Peterson just basically says, yeah, but what are you going to do with the other half of the population?
Yeah.
And both the church and those who consider themselves outside the church or anti-church have to wrestle with that. Here we are, borrowing a noadic flood. We all got each other to deal with. And it's, we might count it as a blessing that Christians and non-Christians have a great deal in common from which to build and perhaps to have fruitful conversations. And I think as modernity continues to break down, which it will, the open questions. So David Sloan Wilson comes around and basically says, you know, we don't even see our own software. And Stephen Smith comes around and says, you know, that fight in San Diego about this cross that's on a hill on public land, these symbols are really important. All of our, and Jordan Peterson-esque, we're all behaving like these symbols are really important.
Yeah.
You burn a flag or you put up a Black Lives Matter sign or, you're a 57-year-old man who decides as a minister, you know, if I strolled out to preach one Sunday in a dress and pantyhose, that symbolism would matter. It would matter to the people in the room. It would matter to those who watched on video. It would matter to my wife. It would matter to my children. It would matter to my denomination. I'm not making any statements here. I have no intention on wearing a dress and pantyhose next Sunday, but at some point you have to take a step back and say, what's going on with this stuff?
Yeah, yeah, and it's code logic, right? It's the symbol that is signing a whole world of silent presuppositions, or, you know, kind of halfway articulated, halfway worked out, almost worldview level assumptions that they're invisible. That I was studying rhetoric in the context of teaching senior thesis for a number of years, and it blew me away to realize prior to Descartes how much the conversation in rhetoric and in philosophy and in dialectic was aware of that kind of presuppositional framework. And you see that in C.S. Lewis in Abolition of Man. It shows up there. It shows up in that Reinhold Niebuhr essay I sent you, Church in a Secular Age. You see it in the new rhetoric conversation. It's like Richard Weaver saying, you cannot open your mouth and speak without becoming a preacher. Like that, you are always preaching, because if you unpack it, if you camp out with a statement long enough, you realize, this makes you think of Jordan Peterson, like directed attention or realization, relevance realization. It's like you're interested. You're already interested before you even say a word. And there's a whole world behind that. So yeah, like whether it's dressing a certain way or trying to advocate a certain idea, or even just having this conversation, you and I are interested. Like we have an agenda, and we could unpack that. But I think what's troubling about the last couple of years since we've spoken, we were talking about Jordan Peterson and the university, but it's like things were getting bad then, and then COVID comes around, economic crisis, all that was wrong has been, you know, all that's been deconstructing in the modern world has been happening for decades.
Yeah.
And now it's like jet fuel added to the tension.
Yeah.
And sometimes with justice. I mean, they're real hurts. There's real injustice.
Yeah.
And it feels really urgent that we learn. And that's what I love about you and John Bourbaki having such respectful. I think of Jonathan Haidt in this sense too. Like, bridge building across the camps, because otherwise we're just in an echo chamber. We're just in a bubble.
Yeah.
And we're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's bad preaching. I've always had, it is very common for me to listen to a sermon and hear basically the insinuation and the subtext in the sermon that says to the gathered congregation, we know everything. We know everything. We're the good guys. We're the hope of the world. And it's basically just a far more wordy version of Jesus' parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector going up to the temple to pray.
Yeah.
Oh, dear Lord, thank you. You didn't make me like a social justice warrior. Thank you. You didn't make me like a Trump voter. Thank you. You didn't make me like a secularist. And I see it in churches, and I see it outside of churches. Praise God, for a long time we've been playing these games and we haven't gone out and harmed each other. But there's the sense that, well, maybe we're losing some of that buffer, and we don't humanity has many times played out these scenarios.
Right.
And we don't want to do this. We don't want to do this. Let's please talk, and let's please be generous with one another. And, you know, and then with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, just, you know, 6 weeks before this enormously contentious election, given the move that was made at the end of the Obama administration, and it's like, oh, you know, did we really need another intensifier in our midst?
Right.
Did the stakes really need to go higher? At least in the minds of both camps. And I see this, you know, at the same time, you know, the video that I may or may not make today about there's a congregation in Grand Rapids that has decided that, you know, now is the time to announce to the denomination that they have ordained a deacon in a same-sex marriage. And it's like, now is the time mm-hmm. for the Christian Reformed Church to have to process this conflict at the mm-hmm. same time that I'm meeting with another church that is saying, you know, we're thinking of leaving the denomination. And to them I go, but they're over on the conservative end. And so I want to go to them and say, and I did go to them and say, is now the time
right.
to do this? So, yeah, I think now is the time. Now is the time to be patient. Now is the time to talk. Now is the time to don't have to change anything right now. Mm-hmm. Let's handle, you know, at the beginning of the Civil War when, you know, the Union is blockading the South, and that's a very economically important thing with respect to England, who was buying all that cotton that yep. slaves were producing, and that was going to go to England. And so I don't recall if the American Navy had grabbed a British merchant ship or something had happened that basically, you know, would have easily sparked a war with Great Britain. And of course, at that point, the United States was not a superpower and Great Britain was, and Abe Lincoln sort of backed down from the conflict and said, one war at a time.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Let's have one war at a time. Let's not fight the South and Britain because, you know, the French and Indian War was part of a world war, and we've had numerous yes. world wars yeah. since Christopher Columbus in many ways united the world.
That's
so,
right. Yeah. No, that's right. And it's a healthy reminder that, you know, my few decades and pretty much unparalleled prosperity and comfort is actually, it's atypical. This isn't normal history. You know, you grow up in it and you think it is. And so once it gets disrupted, you think, well, what's going on? You know, is this... I'm going to say, have you heard of Ken Bailey? Kenneth
yes.
Bailey.
Yeah. I've got some of his books right here.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm reading this book, Jacob yeah. and the Prodigal.
Yes.
It's so good.
Yes.
And it's so relevant to what we're talking about here. The richness of the Father's love that is for both sons, and just the palpable division I just see such a parallel there. You know, Niebuhr sees it as a parallel for secularism. It's sort of ideational, but this is really relationally rich. Jesus is showing us the generosity of God. And nobody had said it in those terms. It's wherever you are on the spectrum, I think Bailey's vision is so helpful. I would love to hear, I think if I could, I want to ask you, if Jordan Peterson is on sabbatical, what's his reading list, Pastor Paul? What would you give it? What's your top reading? What would be your number one recommendation?
For Jordan to read something that he hasn't read. That's a good question, because if I were Jordan's pastor, you know, I don't know if I'd hand him a book so quickly because he's read so many of them, but I would really want him to have a sabbatical, and I would really want him to rest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe, that's a really good question. Ooh, wow. Wow. You know, I've been, you know, doing some thinking about Dostoevsky lately, and the conversation that I just posted today that I had yesterday was, a big fan of Dostoevsky. And so then I watched a couple videos this morning about Dostoevsky's life. What a crazy life. But, you know, so he, you know, part of what he did when he was imprisoned was about the only thing he had access to was the New Testament, and he read it. I think what I would maybe I would ask Jordan Peterson to read the Gospels and to suggest to him that if he's going to be a culture warrior, that he become a disciple of, I think, the world's greatest culture warrior, which was Jesus Christ. Because, you know, it occurred to me a number of years ago that that especially the Gospels are a description of a man navigating a culture war that was more intense, certainly more violent than our own.
Right.
And if you understand Jesus as a culture warrior, and you look, let's look at straw men of two sides of our current culture war, let's say a Christian fundamentalist on one side, or maybe let's say a Christian progressive social justice warrior on the other, I don't find either of them learning from Jesus as culture warrior. Because, you know, Jesus was eventually, he was killed by the Romans, one side of the culture war, but the other side of the culture war cashed in chips to get him there.
Yeah.
And if there's a political party that Jesus should have been closest to, it was the Pharisees.
Right.
Because he wasn't out in the desert living his life in a cave like an Essene. He wasn't looking for opportunities for the violent overthrow of the Roman occupation. And so if you understand this context and you see what Jesus is doing, it's astoundingly cagey. And it's infuriating to both sides of the culture war. And maybe if Jordan Peterson would read the Gospels carefully in this light, he would begin to say, well, shoot, if I act this way, I've already had my wife already has cancer, and I've already had a medical crisis with, you know, benzodiazepines. Why would I want to infuriate both sides of this camp? And I would probably say, well, Jordan, you already kind of did. But
yeah, that reminds me a little bit of the, you know, kind of David Fuller's, if he has a critique. I know he appreciates Jordan a lot, and but if there's one little critique, it sounds similar to what he has said about Jordan has a hard time integrating postmodern voices, and there's a little bit of a polarization that's going on in terms of. Yeah, and maybe that's the same polarization with the God side conversation, and just the Sam Harris, like, I've got my corner of the truth market that I'm really interested in preserving, and we all do, but like, you know, if we don't recapture and rediscover and relearn some of our old dialogue and mutual respect, I don't see this ending well.
It just sort of blows up, and then the ashes coalesce to become the fuel for the next fight. And that's one way of understanding human history and revolutions. Yeah. They just keep happening, which is why we call them revolutions.
Yeah.
But you know, I think part of the so when I look at, you know, I think Jordan's wave towards the end of it became decadent, and part of what happened to him was this, what, of course, the Knights and Mooks article that came out a couple months ago. I don't know if you've read that.
No, I haven't.
You very much should. Mm. But it basically is a story and some audience capture where, and I remember Dave Rubin, you know, the live events that I would go to, Dave Rubin would come out and he would basically play the tribal card. We're the good side. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're winning. And so I found that extremely distasteful. And, mm-hmm. and I think Jordan, in a sense, was captured by his own success in some ways towards the end. And when you look at Jesus, he never was. There were moments in the gospel when, you know, up in the Galilee, a group want to make him king. Mm. Nope, he won't do it. John 6, he's tremendously popular and looks around and says, you know, yeah, the Romans have their bread and circuses, and my miracles of food are your bread and circuses, and I won't have it. So unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no part of me. And it's, and then the triumphal entry, the march into Jerusalem, Hosanna, he simply refuses to be captured by his audience. And so again and again, you know, and his disciples, you know, this small group, and of course there's 12 chosen, and there's maybe, you know, maybe 120 or so real hardcore loyalists around him. Not the brightest tools in the shed by their own admissions, but, you know, even they abandoned him. Mm. And so if there are lessons to be learned from the Gospels in terms of how to live in the midst of a culture war, and in all likelihood, every generation does to one degree or another.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a big lesson that, You cannot allow yourself to be captured by your audience. You cannot allow them to cast Messiahship. You cannot allow them to cast Messiahship for you.
Yeah. Right.
And that's the more successful you are, the stronger that will become.
Yeah. What did you say the other day on a video? Status binds and blinds you.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that makes me want, you know, I think about the temptations in the desert. It's like, what is Jesus actually being tempted by? Well, it's food. You know, that's creature comfort, food. But safety and fame, the next two temptations. And you just ask yourself, how often are my drives determined by food, safety, and the desire for fame? And if, you know, if I were to get a percentage readout on my soul, oh my, you know. So yeah, that's really good. I think learning how to be a culture warrior from Jesus, and I like that too, because I often hear culture war is sort of used as a negative thing. It's a sign of things going wrong, and a lot's going wrong in a culture war. But what's the good way to do culture war? What's the faithful way to do that? I've heard that come in a couple of videos recently too. That's been helpful.
Well, you do have to. I mean, culture war is. It's perpetual with us. It'll always be with us. And and Christians should prosecute the culture war, but they have to prosecute it like Jesus. And that's the definition of it. And it's just extremely costly. Hmm. Because, well, I suppose if you do it right, you'll be crucified. Hmm. And yet, you know, there are ways to be crucified as a Christian that are very unchristlike too. And we've seen that how many times throughout history?
Sure. Yeah.
So, and so then when we look at the secular, well, so part of, you know, Stephen Smith's work, that's the author of this book. And I want to get him into more videos, at least some of his lectures, treatment of this book into more videos. You know, in some ways, the United States is built on the God is not mentioned once in the American Constitution.
Right.
He is in the Declaration of Independence, but not in the Constitution.
Right.
And the Bill of Rights, you know, the Establishment Clause, the United States will not establish a church. I mean, that's deeply contextualized by the end of the 18th century and the fact that most of the colonies had state churches. Okay.
Right.
And so basically the end of modernity is secularity as a free open space has been extraordinarily useful in avoiding the kinds of wars that the Protestant Reformation sparked.
Right.
And so the United States was ahead of the curve on that, but Europe eventually caught on to it. Freedom of religion, freedom of conviction, the end of the tyranny of the church. But as we continue to recognize that secularity isn't the outdoor space as opposed to the inside the churches, we start to lose some of the benefits that secularity has afforded. And so if we could all sort of act like Christians and act like we believed in God, but not go to church and say we didn't believe in God, and in other ways act like God wasn't there. I mean, when you look at how we've managed to achieve this period of remarkable peace and security and affluence that we've enjoyed in the United States, secularity has been a big part of that. And even though preachers and churches have sort of railed against it, they too have benefited from it.
Yeah. It's created the marketplace of ideas, the marketplace of competitive, you got to go out and earn your hearing, and we're not going to mess with that. Yeah. That's right. And I think too, like the deeper history of, well, where did the framers come up with this idea that we need a relatively open space? It wasn't because they were against religion. It's that they assumed that religion was well taken care of. And so we need a relatively neutral space to dialogue, because it was understood there were already confessional divisions. Right. And so it wasn't uninterested. It was highly interested. Like we're going to need a common space. What's your fourfold word? The sacred, imaginary,
the symbolic, dramatic, liturgical, imaginary.
Yeah. It maps onto something I discovered in studying rhetoric, kind of in the new rhetoric movement, but there's you know, Aristotle has three appeals. Like the appeal to passion, the appeal of character. If you trust me, my message is going to be appealing to you. And then there's logos. Like am I speaking sense, or am I, includes logic, but it's much more than that. I was kicking this around and realized from some scholars, and actually it was an article on advertisement. The fourth appeal is mythos, story.
Huh.
It's like the atmosphere surrounding. And I came up with a little diagram, because, you know, the Greek lambda has two legs and a union point. It's like, oh, those are the three appeals. So that's Aristotle. But what is it about Aristotle's outlook on the world that allows his three to be appealing? It's this story verse. It's this, like, the scholar, I think it was James Murphy, He goes with his meta rhetoric. You know, you can get all verbiage, kind of academic speak, but it's, in my mind, it's this bubble surrounding the lambda. And it's like the world you live in. Of course, this makes me think of your heritage and the Dutch Reformed who basically gave us our vocabulary of worldview in this country. And I would, you know, if I had a wish list for not so much for Jordan, but I want to throw this out because I put it in my notes and I gotta put this out before our time ends. So John Vervaeke, I loved his, I didn't see them all, but I loved the last one. And I feel like it's cheating to watch the last one. He packs so much in there. But I hear him talking about his whole idea is waking up to your bubble is getting popped. Your bubble is in crisis, right? In the West. And, I would love to hear John interact with some confessional theological voices, not so much Tillich and Heidegger, because I feel like, you know, he talks about the autonomy versus heteronomy dialectic. And it feels to me like those guys are never going to get us out of that back and forth.
Yeah.
But it would be really interesting to hear him engage with some more, like C.S. Lewis and Bart and Niebuhr, where we've got this confessional space where we're really recognizing, yeah, we are coming from faith, but so are you.
Yeah.
we're all Augustine faith seeking understanding. Yeah. Or, you know, that's just true of human beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if we started there, I wonder if it would create space for listening a little bit more and a little bit more patiently in the crossroads of dialogue and exchange. What was I assuming again? Yeah. Help me back up.
Yeah. 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 You know, and it's interesting. You're bringing Niebuhr into, you know, into the conversation here. And when you sent me, you know, the church and the secular age, because it's so weird how in many ways these things move so slowly.
Yeah.
Yet each decade is important. I don't know when Niebuhr wrote what you sent me, probably in the, I don't know, mid 20th century, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Just given his, when he lived. Mm-hmm. But the whole neo-Orthodox movement, Bart, Niebuhr, in some ways, you know, for decades before them, there had been all of these attempts to try to rescue Christianity, and now let's use the Weber, Taylor definition of secularity. There had been all of these attempts to try to rescue the sunk costs of Christianity from the disenchantment.
Mm.
You know, God didn't save the Jews from Hitler. God didn't save us from the Second World War. Did God save us from the Cold War and the nuclear annihilation we faced? But so the Neo-Orthodox in some ways wanted to, you know, maintain their respectability in terms of not crossing the enchantment line, or at least, you know, coming, but they're dealing with it there. And so you see Bart in a number of ways, you know, the fundamentalists and the Pentecostals just, you know, gave disenchantment the finger, said, yep, we don't care about your, yeah, you know, we're
yeah,
you know, you can keep your ivory tower and your fancy names and your fancy science, and we don't care if you're, we don't care how you're finding the oil or where you're developing the medicine, we're going to use it and we're going straight forward. So they don't care.
So true.
But the Neo-Orthodox, you know, they're wrestling with it. And of course Tillich is, is coming out of that same, that all of those projects are trying to do that. And so if you, you know, if I would pull biblical commentaries, you know, out of that movement as well, they're, you know, they're all dealing with it. How can we have Jesus, of what value is Jesus to us without the miraculous and without the second coming and without him breaking down the wall? And it's interesting how that concern continues to be in the conversations today. Sam Harris very much wanting Jordan Peterson to deny the historicity of the resurrection. And it's like, you know, Sam, you're sort of showing us what battles you still care about. And in many ways, so much of what Jordan was on was, well, whatever with respect to the historicity. And in that way, Jordan was in some ways deeply postmodern.
Yeah.
But then saying, what about the mythos? Because
I want to jump in because that word, what about the true mythos?
Yeah.
What about C.S. Lewis, who wrote so eloquently about the vision of the pillar of light in Perelandra to which all things bowed? And you read a little Einstein and you realize that's not bad science, actually. So you want to talk about science. What if the God who spoke and the cosmos banged into 15 billion year existence is the light of the world? He says that about himself. And it's like, could literature, could science fiction, could children's stories that are written be possibly some of the most subversive 20th century literature, because it's not scientifically naive. They're going through time and space portals according to the real absolute of the cosmos. And it's not space and time, Isaac Newton. I think the conversation, like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, it's like they're getting their philosophy and their science of religion from the 18th century, but they're living in the 21st. Serious physicists became Christians in the early 20th century because of their interaction with science.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was the theology of Thomas Torrance, T.F. Torrance, deeply engaged with Barth and the early church, but also, in decades long conversations with, elementary particle physicists and quantum physics, that conversation is not factoring into the meaning crisis. And I think it could, and I think it would be wonderful to hear Harris discover. I don't have an agenda. I'd love for him to convert, but I'd love for him to convert his attitude and his outlook, or Dawkins, to just the respect that a guy like John Polkinghorne or Alistair McGrath is in Tom Torrance. These are serious scientists and Orthodox Christian belief, Orthodox Christians.
Yeah.
And I would love to see the meaning crisis invaded with a little bit more of that. Because like you said, the Pentecostal and fundamentalist, and I love our brothers that, they've got a billion more Christians in the world than old line reform people, but have a little respect for the conversation that's been going on for the last century. And that goes all around.
Well, and I think it's not embarrassing so much. There's an offensive posture that the church can take when we trot out a Polkinghorne and say, well, how do you like that? And because I think the church, when it wins, and the church seldom The church usually doesn't behave. Winning is almost always an invitation to behave poorly. So when the church wins, it doesn't always behave well with its winning. But, you know, John Vervaeke's quest is, I think the church needs to look very seriously at it, because we don't know, because I very much believe, you know, but sort of where my last videos have been going, that modernity is ending, and for all of the reasons that we've talked about here, you know, Dawkins and Harris like to posture themselves, and many have believed themselves to be talking about the Church of Rationality that is in the future, but Auguste Comte got there generations before, and every time this has been tried, it's come up empty. And so, but the church itself has also not seriously reckoned with what this means for us either. You know, if we imagine that let's say the Roman Catholic Church at the height of its power in the late medieval period, you know, say what we may about the sins of the Protestant Reformation, the tyranny of the church needed to be broken.
Right.
And it was broken. And the impotence that the church feels today, you know, is part of the bitter lessons that the church needs to remind ourselves with respect to how we need to behave in this world. And so my concern, you know, whereas it is certainly in a tribal way, it is certainly gratifying, you know, if Jordan Peterson, you know, recovers in some therapy place in Croatia and, you know, calls Tom Wright and says, "Tom, during my convalescence, I've read your books. You're right about the resurrection. I renounce what I said to Sam Harris. I believe. And John Vervaeke, after all of our dialogue, says, "Paul, I'm going back to church and I embrace Jesus as my Lord and Savior." And all the, you know, in the tribal way, all of that is gratifying. When James Tour, it's fun watching James Tour go to conferences and say, y'all really don't know how life began. Come on, just admit it. Because I know what you know, and it doesn't make any sense. So there you are. I mean, there's something deeply gratifying about that. But when the church likes to posture itself as if it has all the answers, and Jerry Falwell Jr. and his wife have not been able to establish a mutually satisfying model of sexuality in alignment with Christian teaching, this should remind us in the church that the not yet of the now and the not yet is really pretty strong.
Yeah.
And that we remain pilgrims who suffer in a cruciform space. Mm. And so in that way, I do want to both practice estuary and facilitate others practicing it by learning about my shortcomings from those who, for one reason or another, say to me, "I just can't believe what you say you believe."
Yep.
And I think the church needs to figure out how to both continue to embrace its historical traditional beliefs and practice those other things, because you you know, what did we learn about the Lord from the prophets of Baal? Mm. What do Christian Trinitarians learn about Jesus Christ from Arius? Mm. You know, and I think, I do believe, and my probably not terribly accurate reading of Alistair McGrath's good little book, Heresy, mm. Orthodoxy and heresy co-generate as we go through time.
Right.
And for the fight that at least churches in the West are in right now with respect to, you know, that say how we regard same-sex behavior and attraction and how that is dealt with in terms of the community. I suspect new orthodoxies will emerge from this struggle, that and new formulations of orthodoxy that are difficult for us at this moment to appreciate, perhaps the way it was difficult in the second century to appreciate Christology and Trinitarian theology. So I'd like us in the church to be the kinds of conversation partners that Sam Harris might decide to lay down some of his winning arguments on YouTube ways and say, let's have a real conversation with a Christian about what they believe and what we believe, and maybe at the end of it a little bit of Vervaekian dialogos can happen. And I think if we can practice this on stages and in churches and in the academy, in a whole lot of other ways in dealing with bitter histories of racism and sexism and class warfare, maybe we can have more justice, and maybe we can have more peace, and maybe we can have more love. But I don't think it'll happen when we imagine there's no religion. So
thank you, John Lennon.
Yes.
that's well said. Well, I should probably let you go, Paul. I just heartily affirm that, and thank you for slogging it out and continuing to work for that dialogue. And it's an inspiration to me, and I know for a lot of people. So I wanted to tell you I'm grateful. I think in many ways you're modeling exactly what you just said. It's the, what does it look like to be his disciple? I don't know, but I'm on board.
Well, thank you, Bryce. And thanks for sending me the stuff that you sent me. And I haven't had a chance to really digest, but I really appreciate the conversation partnering that you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Well, we'll check in again sometime.
Okay. I have permission. I can post this.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Real good.
Okay.
Thank you, Bryce.
Yeah. Thank you, brother. See ya.
Take care. Bye-bye.